Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A story today about a symbol you and I know very well, a potent symbol you probably connect with white supremacy, terror, and mass murder. It's also a symbol that goes back thousands of years in history and carries from different cultures a very different meaning. The symbol I'm referring to, what most of us know as the swastika. This hour is also the story of how a Depression-era mural at the Cedar Rapids City Hall came to include a swastika on a Native American teepee, of all places. But let's start by hearing from Ashley Van Norney, who was just elected to the Cedar Rapids City Council. During the campaign, she happened to mention the swastika on the mural.
Well, and it really was a side conversation. You know, I spent so many months going and taking notes and doing my homework at city council meetings and was often there with Brian Morelli, who works for the Gazette, and he and I had developed a pretty good working relationship and just pointed it out to him. It's very tiny, but it stands out to me because where it is behind the two monitors, where they're constantly displaying agenda items. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you sit there enough over many months and then you start to really notice kind of all the cracks in the wall and all this and that. So.
Oh, right. You have a lot of time to look at it and ponder why it's there. So to make it clear to our listeners here on the radio, the swastika is on the side of a teepee under the arm of a bare-chested Native American. He's standing in front of a teepee, and this image, this mural, is above the public entrance to the city council chambers, correct?
It's off to the left, but yes.
Mm-hmm. So, and your mention of it to Brian Morelli of the Gazette was in what context? And did you say, we've got to get rid of that?
Well, really just friends having conversation, you know, at first confirming that my eyes weren't deceiving me. And, you know, the first thing that I did was just recall having grown up, my dad and, all of us were quite nerdy, and I'm very proud of that. I own that part of myself. You know, but we grew up watching the History Channel, so I went and did some research, and I think that's what's often not talked about in this story is that I'm well aware of the background of, and it wasn't originally called the swastika. You know, it had some Hindi references, it had mm-hmm. some Native American references prior to the Nazis' perversion of it. But, you know, I still thought, you know, it's hard to, even knowing all of that, it's hard to unsee it. And I certainly don't want to interject myself into this mural. You know, there's a lynch scene in the mural that gave cause to why it was originally covered up.
That is separate. That is a different sort of image, different than the swastika image. It's not together, right? Or is it?
Right. But it's you know, just down the street from it. I mean, it's on the same wall. You know, so there's a lot of really powerful imagery. And I'll say this. A lot of my friends liken me to Leslie Knope, and I think she's adorable on Parks and Recreation, this character. And what's interesting is that, you know, there's a meme that I really like about her, a quotation from the show, and it said, what I hear when people are something to the effect of, you know, when people are yelling at me, what I hear is them caring loudly. And so, you know, regardless of how people, it's a divisive issue. It was never intended to be anything that I meant to, you know, to draw interest to my campaign or anything like that. You know, I just tend to be somebody who likes to chat and have conversations about all sorts of things. You know, this is just a minuscule moment that, right. that happened in the day and it ended up in the press. And I guess, you know, it's a little bit naive of me to necessarily let my guard down and have just any old conversation with anybody. you know, like I said, and I know that Morelli had the best intentions when he was publishing this, you know, but for me being a new candidate, you know, I'm not a politician. I'm a public servant. I do a lot of work in the nonprofit area, right. You know, that I'm not paid for. This is just my volunteer advocacy work. And it was just something kind of an oversight, if anything, you know, where I didn't realize how much, how divisive it would be. But, you know, I guess in light of the fact that statues have been taken down this year and this and that and the other, you know, it's probably something I should have kept in mind. So it was an opportunity, though, the nice part about it was an opportunity to discuss art with, you know, fellow Cedar Rapidians and some outsiders too, you know, the Gazette has a pretty wide reach. But I think what we have to make certain of is, regardless of how, you know, art is what's beautiful about it is the fact that it is supposed to elicit powerful emotions, whether that's sadness or happiness or joy or anger. You know, it wouldn't be my preference to have artwork like this in City Hall, because some of it, I think, you know, some context with a placard or something like that would really serve it better. Even highlighting the restorative efforts that they went to, you know, my understanding is that it was pretty painstaking to restore this after it was covered up and kind of found underneath. And, you know, I don't see anybody talking about that work. And I think it would have made for a nice display or something, you know, to have some kind of context to it and talk through and give that sort of historical value
to
the work.
Right. And Ashley, that's exactly what we're going to do later in the program. We'll delve into the history of this mural, not just the symbol found on the teepee here.
Terrific.
But tell us, it's interesting, too. You have another connection here, I understand, through Brian Morelli's reporting that your grandfather fled Germany in the 1930s?
He did. And I think that was something that, you know, a lot of people, you know, kind of got raked over the coals for it. And again, that's people just caring loudly, as I will phrase it. But, you know, what people didn't understand is when I see that symbol, and I spoke, you know, one of my first calls after I saw that article come out was to Rabbi Todd, and I just said, you know, how do you feel about this? And I know that the Interfaith Alliance agrees with me. It's not something that they are excited is in there, and I certainly am not going to speak on their behalf more than that. But you know, they told me that we've got your back if you need any help addressing this issue. Now, when I see that symbol, the historical reference and significance that has for me is that my grandfather, John Farrell, was a Dinara boy. And so when he was fleeing World War II, he escaped to England. And, you know, England, just like today, I mean, the refugee problem is not something that's new. And I say problem because that's how a lot of people are viewing it, instead of, you know, kind of looking at it from the humanity side. And they did then, too. You know, there was an influx of people. England didn't know what to do with them. They have later since said that this is one of the most embarrassing, you know, blemishes on their history. But what they did is they rounded up all the refugees fleeing World War II, you know, fleeing Nazi persecution. They put them on, you know, the equivalent of a slave ship and shipped them down to an internment camp in Australia. You know, Australia was routinely a prison island for England's misfits, if you will. And, you know, the English side of my family got there, you know, after I don't know how many minor infractions that built up enough to send them, you know, as a prisoner down there many, many, many decades ago. But then the German side on my, you know, maternal side, that's how they got there. They were mm-hmm. political refugees, and they were rounded up and sent off to get away from England. So,
Ashley, it sounds like you've had quite a bit of reaction to this. What you initially said is just a comment to Brian Morelli. How much reaction have you from the community, from the press?
Oh, you know, people are. I love working for the people. I have always chosen, you know, I've worked some retail jobs, and that's pretty much the only time that I've ever worked for private companies, but I have always enjoyed public service, and that's just something that means a lot to me. But particularly on the internet, you know, people behind a screen get quite brave, and I think what they didn't realize is that I actually care enough that I was following all the comments, and I was trying to engage them in conversation.
What sorts of conversations, when you put it under the category of caring loudly, what's the loudest bit of caring, if I can put it that way, that surprised you?
Yeah, and I don't want to give some of the trolls, you know, their 15 minutes of fame because they don't deserve it. You know, really, what people have to do is that if they actually have a question, particularly somebody who's a public figure or, you know, or one of their representatives or anything like that, they need to talk with them in person. They need to reach out. You know, I had somebody who sent a letter to my house you know, kind of scolding me for not knowing the history, which, first off, I had more than done the history on this. Talked with Brian Morelli about that. We both knew that, you know. Maybe it wasn't captured how much I understood, fully understood, you know, what the symbol meant predating World War II. But I knew that. And somebody, you know, sent me a letter in the mail, and they didn't return any contact information. I was like, well, see, this is the problem. You're not actually, you know, intending on having a conversation. And this is where political discourse breaks down. And this is where we get divisive politics. Now, I love the fact that I'm working in a nonpartisan office because that kind of stuff can get shelved, right? Because it doesn't matter. You know, somebody on council, a good friend of mine, you know, she said it best. And she said, it doesn't matter what party politics are when it comes to making sure that your toilet's flush, making sure you've got clean water, making sure that you've got drivable streets.
All right.
So people have to remember what, you know, what my role in their environment is. And it's serving the city, serving all people, regardless of political affiliation. You know, none of that matters. You know, we all generally are registered, you know, this party or that party, but that is gets shelved aside when it comes to city politics. And so I think the main thing that I would encourage everybody to do is maybe just kind of check some of their tude, so to speak, at the door and actually have an adult conversation, you know, because this isn't the Ashley show. You know, I don't take over as a leader in the community, you know, steamrolling over, you know, what the community's decisions are. Certainly, there's been a lot of people who are quite vocal about keeping this artwork because of the historical value. You know, my mission has always really been about entertaining inclusivity, and not, well, I shouldn't say just entertaining, but really, you know, engaging in that. That's something that I do at the University of Iowa. You know, I actually take a lot of vacation time and invest in courses regarding diversity. And so I am always, you know, have that kind of on my shoulder that I want to make sure that I am welcoming all people.
Let me finish up this conversation by just getting a clear sense of what you see this as a priority. Is it a priority in any way for you to have this symbol removed or the mural covered up in some way? Because it doesn't seem like you like the mural as a whole either.
Well, you know, the mural is not the best piece of artwork. And by the way, if anybody wants a copy, I'd be happy to send them a copy in the mail if they love it that much. But
it's viewable on the Cedar Rapids City Council website also.
I mean, to be honest, I would be very surprised if anybody would want this in their house. Let's put it at that, you know. But I just spent some time visiting my cousin in London and had the opportunity to see some incredible artwork there. You know, I actually am a huge fan of art in general. So that's not my point. And particularly, you know, honoring, you know, our constitutional amendments of freedom of speech, that is not what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to cover up history. I'm not trying to cover up anybody's voices or the opinion that existed in the 1930s. But I challenged Cedar Rapidians to make sure that our imagery, you know, is well positioned in, you know, when we're presiding over the dais.
Right.
So I think those kind of things are things that we need to, you know, to maybe add some context to it. And I think that we can, you know, kind of in the spirit of Kaizen, I think we can build on what we have and always improve. And I think at the very least, we can put, you know, some sort of exhibit that gives some background to what, you know, what this artwork meant, some of the symbolism behind it and what that meant in the 1930s, and just talk about it and be transparent. You know, that's what we have to do is talk.
Right. I guess it gets down to a fundamental question, and I don't know if you can leave us with an answer to this because it's a difficult question. How do we decide, you're in public office now or soon to be in public office, how do we decide how offensive something has to be to how many people before it's taken down or covered up in a public setting?
You know, you kind of have to take the temperature of folks, right? So it has to be a community conversation. You know, but I think at the very least, we owe it to ourselves to bring that context, not just to wait until somebody asks, but to make sure that we're being transparent and putting that stuff, you know, in front of Cedar Rapidians before they have a chance to question it, you know, and just give them all the information.
Okay, very good. Ashley Van Norney, city councilor-elect in the Cedar Rapids City Council, thank you very much for this conversation, and congratulations again on your election.
Thank you. Thank you. I look forward to serving my hometown. I love it very much.
Coming up after a short break, we explore the origins of this controversial mural at the Cedar Rapids City Hall.
what the swastika has meant throughout history in different cultures, how symbols can change their meaning, be co-opted, and why that matters. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Let's pick up where we left off in the first half hour, if you were with us. The strange story of how a swastika came to be included on a teepee pictured on a mural at the Cedar Rapids City Hall. In the first half hour, we talked with a councilor-elect, Ashley Van Norney, who made this comment to the Cedar Rapids Gazette reporter, Brian Morelli, and it's gained a lot of attention. She talked about her perspective there, but we want to find a little bit more about this mural and also how symbols may change, in this case, be co-opted over time. Joining us now, Sean Ulmer is with us, director of the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art. Hi, Sean.
How are you doing, Ben?
I'm doing well. Also with us, Elizabeth Heineman, professor and chair of the History Department at the University of Iowa. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there. It's great to be with you.
Great to be with you, both of you. Sean, tell me, now you can go to the Cedar Rapids City Hall website to see the mural that we're talking about, but as described in the first half hour, part of this mural depicts a Native American chief standing outside a teepee and under, I think his shoulder is a swastika on a teepee. Tell me about how this mural came to Cedar Rapids and how we have that symbol on the teepee.
Well, it's actually one of four murals that are on the four walls that surround what is now City Council Chambers. It was originally a courtroom. The building was originally a federal courthouse, and this was a major court space. And there were a variety of different themes. It was really created by four different artists. Each one tackled a different wall. And the wall that we're talking about today was created by Everett Jeffrey, who was originally from Oxford Mills, Iowa, just south of Oxford Junction. And he was largely self-taught and was working here in Cedar Rapids, went to Stone City Art Colony for the first year. But then he banded together with several other artists in the area to create what was called the Mural Painters Group of Cedar Rapids. And at this time, in the early 30s, with all of the projects under the sort of the big umbrella of the WPA, many artists and artists groups were applying for mural work to stay employed. And this project for the federal courthouse was actually under the auspices of the Treasury. It was the Treasury Relief Art Project, or TRAP, which ran from 1935 to 1939. It kind of picked up where the Public Works of Art Project, PWAP, left off. And this was one of the projects that TRAP oversaw. And as I said, the artist Everett Jeffrey was responsible for this particular mural, which is 60 feet long, and about 5.5 feet tall, so kind of this big band along sort of the roof line, the ceiling line, I should say, of the space. And his theme on this wall was several different things he touches on, but the two big themes that he looks at is the difference between lynch law and a settled tribunal, kind of prairie justice versus a civilized justice, and that's where you have the lynching scene that was referenced earlier. But then next to that is the difference between superstition, and science, and it is in the context of superstition that this Native American scene appears with several other characters, but sort of this grouping of different people that were sort of categorized as sort of superstitious healing versus scientific healing.
So zero in on that symbol, the swastika. Why did the artist put it there?
Well, indeed, it's not a swastika. That's what we call it today.
Right.
But it's much more likely a kind of a whirling log symbol, which was very popular. This symbol was used by several different groups within sort of the Native American community for over 1,000 years. And so it was used especially by the Navajo, the Hopi, the Apache, and even by our own area Sac group, which become the Meskwaki. And I believe that it was this artist's experience as a child. He didn't always live here in Iowa. He moved with his family Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota, and grew up for a portion of his youth near that, and would have been very familiar with that Native American group, which was the Lakota. And the Lakota used this symbol as a sort of an abridged version of it as a medicine wheel for healing. And so it's not surprising in a theme around healing that he would incorporate that symbol. But there are other symbols on the teepee as well. There's also the symbol for change. And you can see that on the other side of the main character there in front of the teepee. So he's drawing from some very accurate source material, his own experience and his knowledge of Native American communities, to try and make the scene as authentic as possible.
Mm-hmm. Sean Ulmer, director of the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art, Elizabeth Heineman of the History Department at the University of Iowa. Tell us more about, because most of us, a lot of us, will only connect what we call the swastika. It has many different names throughout history with the Nazi Reich, with terror, with white supremacy. But it really has a lot of other dimensions. Sean jumped into one there with Native Americans. Tell us about some other dimensions that go back through history in different cultures.
Yeah, well, you know, Sean's absolutely right that this symbol has a very long history of completely independent existence before it kind of was essentially co-opted, sort of first by German white supremacists, and then, of course, it makes many appearances, you know, in the United States as well. It's a Buddhist symbol, right? If you travel in Buddhist areas today, and just like a tourist map, In our setting, might have a cross to indicate a church, there'll be a swastika to indicate a Buddhist shrine, right? excuse me. The swastika is found in ancient Greece, right? If you go to ancient Greek ruins, you'll sometimes see it there. And that's kind of the place that ends up being the connection many, many centuries later to Europe and the kind of ideological associations we see with it.
Yeah, tell us a little bit of that story briefly, Elizabeth. How and when it was imported to Europe, how it became adopted by the Nazi Party and represent Nazi ideology and Aryan supremacy.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I should say that the swastika also appears on, you know, ancient shards of pottery in Europe as well. I mean, it's a visually pleasing symbol, right? Mm-hmm. It sort of suggests a kind of infinity. You can imagine moving in some places. It sort of just means you sort of think of a labyrinth and that kind of peaceful moving. In some places, it means, you know, sort of suggests the travel of the sun across the sky. So it just appears in all kinds of places. And Europe is one of those places. So what happens is that in the 19th century, the key character here is an archaeologist by the name, the very German name of Heinrich Schliemann. And he's really quite a famous archaeologist at the time. And he was very interested in sort of finding what he thought was going to be sort of the historical facticity of the Iliad and the Odyssey. And he wanted to discover the site of Troy, of ancient Troy. So he went and he, you know, dug around in ancient Greece where he thought Troy was, and he discovered a lot of stuff there, many, many layers of ancient ruins. And at the spot where he thought was ancient Troy, there were, you know, thousands of swastikas. There was a lot of that there. Now, this was a very well-versed archaeologist. He knew that archaeologists working in Europe, sort of in more, you know, central Europe, more his territory by birth, had also found lots of swastikas. So he kind of drew a connection. He said, ah, okay, this must be evidence that there's a connection. Maybe there was some migration, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe there are common ancestors, that kind of thing. Now, you know, what he was, what this intersects with something else that's happening around the same time. Linguists are starting to discover that there are commonalities between Germanic languages and Romance languages and Sanskrit. So they're developing the concepts that we now know today as Indo-European languages. You know, the notion that all those groups have some common roots, right? And what happens is that kind of a discussion of travel, of culture, whether it's language or whether it's use of particular symbols, turns into a discussion of race. And that's because at the same time, in the second half of Europe, of 19th century in Europe, there's another branch of sort of intellectuals and science that are getting very, very interested in the biological notion of race and this idea that there are distinct racial types. So with all this kind of intellectual ferment going on, these things kind of merge in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who are quite obsessed with race, and particularly the notion of purity of race, say, we, Germans, are the descendants of the ancient Greeks, right, who are sort of the font of classical civilization. They use the term Aryan, which initially denotes kind of, you know, people from what we now call India, so that term Aryan comes from there, and they sort of develop this sort of notion that there's this kind of racially pure line that we can document via the use of the symbol, and that unfortunately today, meaning the 19th century, that those lines are polluted by, for example, immigration of Jews, which has been happening over a number of centuries, by the arrivals of people from North Africa and so on. So they're very obsessed with racial purity. The swastika becomes a symbol of the pure racial line that they use the term Aryan.
Very interesting history there, Elizabeth. I want to go back to Sean Ulmer. Our time is running out. We have about 10 minutes left, but I want to get to another few points. So Sean Ulmer, by that description, when we talk about the 1930s, 1936, when this specific mural at the Cedar Rapids City Hall was painted that features a small, what we call a swastika, by this artist, he would have been, even though it seems to be that he's incorporating Native American thought with this symbol, because the Nazis took power in 1933, he would have been certainly aware of Nazi Germany.
I think he would have been aware of it, but it may have been also, I hate to read into what an artist might have been thinking or doing, but it was a symbol he would have been known had existed prior to them and would have known they would have existed, you know, with the Native American cultures that he was trying to picture there. And it may have been also, you know, trying to give it to the people to whom he felt it belonged. But again, that's just simply a guess on my part. It is interesting to note that, you know, there, long before we were even involved in the war ourselves, that people were quite well aware of it. Even the Native American peoples here were aware that that image, that symbol was being co-opted.
Mm-hmm.
The Meskwaki Indians actually came out with a statement in the fall of 1940, before we had actually entered the war, that said that they would no longer use this symbol. And the Hopi and the Navajo and the Apache did the same thing a little bit earlier that year. They said that the symbol had been desecrated by another nation of people, and they ceased to use it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because there are a number of Native American artists out there who are reappropriating, who are reclaiming that symbol and using it again because it ties them into this lineage that went back 1,000 years that they don't feel that they should be severed from. But at the time, even the Native Americans were quite aware that this symbol was being taken over by another nation's people, and they wanted to disassociate themselves from it.
Sean Ulmer, Ashley Varnone is not the first person to stir a little bit of controversy surrounding these murals here. There have been, efforts to cover them up? Have they been covered up?
They have, yes. They were covered up first by the order of a judge who presided in that courtroom in, I think, 1956, if I remember correctly. And it was because of the lynching scene, which sat directly opposite the juror's box. And he felt that that was probably an inappropriate image for the jurors to be focused on while they were trying to deliberate on somebody's fate. And so it was whitewashed. All four murals were. And then they were uncovered again in 1963 and examined. They were in pretty poor condition. They would have taken a lot of money to get together again. And they consulted a few people who said that they didn't think that the quality was all that great. And so they were covered up again. But then they, in the process, post-flood, in the process of restoring that building and converting it from a federal courthouse to City Hall, decided to uncover and restore those murals that now sort of grace the city chambers.
If you just joined us, Sean Ulmer is with us, Cedar Rapids Museum of Art Director Elizabeth Heineman, historian, chair of the History Department at the University of Iowa. We were talking about, well, the root of our story is how a swastika came to be included on a teepee on a mural, one of the murals at the Cedar Rapids City Hall, kind of digging behind it and the history of the swastika. But Elizabeth, tell us, please, a little bit about perhaps some other examples where you see symbols changing meaning, perhaps being co-opted, other examples that come to mind for you.
Well, there's certainly other examples in American history, and perhaps a really important one is the co-optation of the cross by the Ku Klux Klan, right, from a symbol of Christian love and sacrifice to a symbol of terror, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that would be an example that I think resonates with many people in this country. What does it mean to use the cross in that way? I think these are such interesting discussions because there are a lot of voices and there are a lot of and history keeps changing. I love Sean's description of the way during the war many indigenous nations basically said, we're not going to use this symbol, it's been poisoned. And now there's, by some, an attempt to kind of reclaim it, mm-hmm. say, hey, we don't need to be severed from this symbol. It was different people who messed it up. And I think that those kinds of discussions, I think as we have those discussions today, for example, in this context, it's really important to hear those voices. I think it would be, you know, rather than sort of feeling that there's kind of a foregone conclusion, I mean, these are really hard discussions.
Right.
What to do about symbols that have multiple
right.
meanings, some of which are really poisonous. And I think to have indigenous voices from Iowa weigh in on what they now feel is the meaning. You know, would painting it over mean an erasure of indigenous history?
Yeah.
Or would painting it over, you know, be okay or welcome? But I think that's an important voice in the conversation because so often what happens, right, is symbols get sort of alienated and repurposed, and then it becomes very hard to re-enter that discussion.
Let me toss out to both of you to get your thoughts on how you see the discussion we're having now about symbols, the meaning of symbols changing, being co-opted. How does this fit in with the current controversy over Confederate statues and monuments? Those are symbols, very specific symbols, Elizabeth, of a certain period in time.
Well, you know, it's really funny. I just came back. Just last night, I gave a final lecture in a series the History Department did on historical monuments and their meanings. So we've had a lot of discussion of these kinds of symbols. And one of the lectures by Professor Leslie Schwamm was about Confederate statues. And what's so important is to sort of think about the many stages in the history. On the one hand, the statues, let's say Robert E. Lee on a horse, you know, it's a statue of a Confederate general. But typically, these statues were not built in the immediate aftermath of the war. In the immediate aftermath of the war, you have Reconstruction, and then with a failure of Reconstruction or the end of Reconstruction, you have the era of Jim Crow, and these statues are actually built during Jim Crow, not necessarily immediately to memorialize the war itself, but now often a generation or two later. They're often built in the 1920s. Think of it, the Civil War ended in 1865, but these statues might be built in the 1920s with the purpose of sending a message of white supremacy in the American South then and now. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have to think about who was Robert Lee Lee? What was the Civil War all about? We have to think about when was the statue built and why, and how did people understand it in that in those settings, both black and white,
right,
at the time? And now, when people are rallying around it, what is it they're rallying around? Are they rallying around a romantic notion of the Old South? Are they rallying around explicit, violent, you know, white supremacy? Is it possible to separate those two things? Right, there are a lot of things to discuss.
Right, right. We've got a couple minutes left. Sean, jump in here too, because I asked Councilor-elect in our last segment, finally, the question, perhaps you can answer this. How do we decide when something is offensive enough to be taken down? How many people have to be offended before it's taken down or covered up?
Well, I think we have to be very, very cautious. I mean, I think what Ashley was saying is, you know, this has stimulated a lot of discussion, which is great, because I think that echoes exactly what Elizabeth was saying. These are very, very interesting topics and worthy of great discussion. And I think even Ashley said, you know, one of the purposes of a great work of art is to elicit this kind of discussion. And so I think that we have to be very, very careful, because sometimes when you take things away, they cannot come back again. You know, and so I think we always have to take into account the context in which the works were created. I mean, it was not in any way Everett Jeffrey's point to make any statement about Nazi Germany when he was painting these in 1936. Mm-hmm. That was not the point. He was really going for historical accuracy and depicting this particular Native American scene. And so you have to take that, you know, into account. And I think that another point that Ashley was making, which is very, very key, is that, you know, we need to do everything that we can to try and provide that context, to provide that information in order to understand these murals better. And there right. there are panels and explanatory texts outside the city council chambers where the murals are reproduced, okay, and they're broken apart piece by piece. And so people who want more information, it's out there.
Okay. Sean Ulmer, director of the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art. Elizabeth Heineman, professor and chair of the History Department at the University of Iowa. Thanks for illuminating so many facets of this very potent symbol throughout the ages. Sean Ulmer, Elizabeth Heineman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton, with help today from Robbie Broad. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.